Amen. Well, good morning, church. My name is Chase. I'm one of the elders here, and we're going to be in John chapter 18. And we only have, I think, 7 weeks after this in John. So we're getting close to the end. And as Aaron mentioned earlier, we are like just literally moments away from the crucifixion of Christ. And so this is a particular scene that we're in. In fact, John spends most of his account with the conversations with Pilate. The other Gospels don't necessarily do that. So John is the last Gospel to be written. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke are well circulated when John writes his account. And if you remember way back, the very first Sunday, we talked about why John wrote his the way he did. He was writing with like footnotes for us. He's writing this years after Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and so he's letting everyone know, like, those accounts, he's following that rhythm, but he's kind of giving you the cliff notes and also the footnotes. He doesn't really follow a necessary pattern. He does follow the storyline, but sometimes he maneuvers around. In fact, the way it was explained to me is Matthew, Mark, and Luke are standing on three different corners watching a car wreck happen, and they just report it. John is like the eye in the sky who's like in a helicopter telling you how everything happened. And so this conversation that Jesus has with Pilate will start today and will finish next Sunday. But this is a very, very used text to kind of like pull it out of its context and teach whatever you want with it. I've heard like how to be a good business leader out of this text. I've heard like how to be, you know, stand up to the culture in a lot of this text. There's all ways that you can kind of take this text and kind of drive it into a different scenario. But if you don't look at it within its context, you will take it out of context. And so I want to look at it within its context. And then, as we said the past few weeks, when we're in these narrative accounts, there's theological threads that if you begin to pull, it's like when you have a thread on your shirt and you pull it and then all of a sudden you don't have a shirt. It's like one of those things. It kind of just keeps coming. In fact, I hate cats. You know that. Our cats are doing that to our stairs right now. Like one little thread, I'm like, okay, and now our stairs have no carpet on them, just about. So that's kind of what this text will do. You don't have to like be creative and repurpose it and repackage it for it to be relevant, right? It's in context. There's theological implications all over this. And so we're going to do something a little bit different than we normally do as far as how I teach. We're just going to tour guide this thing, all right? And there's no tipping at the end, don't worry. Right, but I'm just going to walk you through this, and we're going to point out some things along the way, and I just want you to see it within its context, within its historical context, and then to begin to pull out some of those theological implications, and it is very rich. And so we're going to focus mainly on John's account, obviously, because that's the book we're in, but we're going to have to pull from Matthew, Mark, and Luke a little bit along the way to kind of fill in those gaps that John overlooks because he's expecting you to have all of that content already in your head. All right, this is like starting the fourth, you know, movie, and they're expecting you to have seen the first three movies, right? It's that kind of a concept. So let's dig in here. 18:28, this is what it says. Then the Jewish leader took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. So if you remember last week, Annas sent Jesus to Caiaphas, that's 18:24, and there was a two-part trial. There was a gathered assembly of the council. We see that from Matthew. And the second trial was the official daylight meeting of the Sanhedrin. That's in Luke 22. So John, like I said earlier, is focused more on the appearance of Jesus before the Roman leader, Pilate. And it says this, by now it was early morning. And that statement is where John's catching you up. He's like, I have just fast-forwarded. We are now just hours from the crucifixion because he says by now it was early morning. That's a transition to where he wants to take you as the reader. And to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So that is like the highest level of hypocrisy you can ever get. The Jewish leaders don't want to enter the palace of Pilate because that will make them ceremonially unclean. However, they're about to commit murder in broad daylight, right? Like, that's hypocrisy, right? Because the reason they don't want to enter into the palace is that the dwelling places of the Gentiles, that's anyone who's a non-Jew, are contaminated and they make you ceremonially unclean. You can't even go into the room of a Gentile, or you cannot participate in Passover. Therefore, they would not want to go in there. And John uses an ironic touch to expose the major hypocrisy. They refused to break relatively one command regarding ceremonial uncleanness, but broke 1,000 other commands in the past 6 hours, not to mention that they're about to crucify God's Messiah, and they're condemning an innocent man to death. That's hypocrisy. Religion, as we just sang, religion is often obsessed with ceremony over substance. I mean, we're really good at this at the Bible Belt. We really are. Religion is great as ceremony, and it's hard to make it substance. The Jews were like meticulous about following the ceremony, cleanliness procedures while putting Jesus to death. Empty ritual is legalistic. If you're just following rules and laws just because you've been told to, or you always have, or it's just the right thing to do, or it's just moral, or it's just this is how I'm going to clean myself up, you are practicing legalism. If you think that God's going to love you more because you follow these commandments, and he's going to favor you over other people, then you are practicing legalism. And this is what the Jews are doing to Christ. Look at verse 29. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" Now, Pilate does not live in this building. We know from history that he lives over near the beach. And he's probably been woken up, and he's had to get across town. He's gotten into his work clothes. He has a tee off at 3 p.m., so he's wanting to wrap this thing up. He's already been woke up on an afternoon when the Jews are supposed to be all occupied doing their Passover thing. He's over here just enjoying a break. And he's been woken up and brought over to his work office, and there is a pressing matter on his docket for the day. So he comes out and says, "What are the charges you're bringing against this man?" So just a little thing about Pilate, he's the fifth governor of Judea. He served between 26 AD and 36 AD, and he's actually not a Roman by blood. He's actually from Spain. So that may have been a little bit of the animosity that he has. And I think this is the biggest reason, is the reason he became the governor over Judea is because he married the granddaughter of Augustus Caesar. So he married in. And you got to think, Romans are pretty tight, and you're not one of us, and you're only got this position because you married a granddaughter, right? You see the little animosity. You see some of the pressure to not let this go above you. You see that? Because if this goes above me, I look bad. I'm not qualified. I'm not cut out for this position. I married in. I'm not good enough. You see some of that tension that Pilate has. Some say that he's a coward for what he did. Maybe he's just complicated, right? And so he got the job and probably has that chip on the shoulder. And we know from history, and also just for if you read the text, he's not a big fan of the Jewish people, nor of their traditions. And so, like I said, he's probably been woken up. He's brought here. All that's coming into place. And so he gets directly to the point. What are the charges? He just comes right out and says, "What are the charges? What's the deal?" He doesn't say good morning. He doesn't say, "Hey, how's the weather?" He's like, "What are the charges? I need to know so I can get out of here." Look at verse 30. This is their response. "If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." Way to avoid the question, right? He's just guilty. Just trust us. We wouldn't have brought him to you. We wouldn't have woke you up. We wouldn't have messed up your golf time if this wasn't a serious matter. Just kill him. That's basically what they're saying. He's guilty. Don't worry about it. Don't ask questions. We know you're busy. Let's just skip this part. And he's guilty. And this is their response. And now I think this is very telling. "We don't need you to judge. We just need you to execute." Okay? Like, that's their response in broad daylight. Verse 31, Pilate said, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," they objected. I mean, it's clear, right, that their objective is execution. They're not, like, leaving with any other decision here. We don't need you to judge him. We don't need you to hear the trial. We just need you to set it up because we can't crucify him. Now, this is very, very important. This is where we need to know the dynamic here. The Jews are to be obedient to the Jewish law and to the law of Rome. Rome has conquered the Jewish people, and as long as they don't intermingle, they can work together and keep the peace. As long as the Jews pay their taxes, Rome usually stays out. But Rome is fully in charge here. The Jews have to be obedient to the Jewish law. That's why they didn't go into the palace. And they need Rome to participate in other ways. So the Pharisees enforce Jewish law, and the Romans enforce Roman law. So every now and then, they did work together to make sure that the Jewish people pay taxes or to carry out punishments. When they say, but we have no right to execute anyone, that's their response. So here it is. We did judge him already. You weren't here for that. You were asleep, as you should have been. We've already done the trial. We just need you to execute him. And according to history, Rome did not allow Jews to carry out capital punishment for obvious reasons. There could be a revolt. There could be, you know, a big scene that could, you know, create, you know, pathways to get not cleared up. Somebody may not pay taxes if you do a killing this day. So Rome did not want them to do that. Like, hey, if you have someone that deserves capital punishment, bring it to us. We'll do their dirty work for you. That's a great partnership, right? Instead, they come to Pilate to let him carry out the death sentence. So now the ball is back in Pilate's court. You can see that Pilate's like, I just want to get back to my life. You do it. You judge them. You do whatever you need to do. And the response is, hey, you won't let us kill people. So now this is awkward, right? That's where they are. Look at verse 32. This took place. This is where I was saying John's footnotes. This took place to fulfill what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. That statement right there tells you that the Jewish leaders are not in control. That sentence right there tells you Pilate and Rome is not in control. That right there tells you Jesus is in full control of every millisecond of this story. Every millisecond. All of this drama and culture or context and all the Roman and Jewish confrontations and discussions, John tells you, hey, this all took place to fulfill what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. Look at John 12, 32. As for me, if I'm lifted up from the earth, I will draw all people to myself. He said this to indicate what kind of death he was about to die. That's John's footnote. It's not a mistake that Jesus was crucified. Do you know what would happen if the Jews found Jesus guilty? They would have done what to him to kill him? They would have stoned him to death. That's the way the Jews would have carried out capital punishment. But what did Jesus say? When I die, I will be lifted up. In John 3, he says, the serpent in the wilderness must be lifted up, as so will the Son of Man be lifted up. And that's when John 12, he says this, I'm going to be lifted up from the earth. In Matthew 20, he says this, while going up to Jerusalem, Jesus took the 12 disciples aside privately and said to them on the way, see, we're going to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. They will hand him over to the Gentiles, that's Pilate, to be mocked, flogged, and crucified, and on the third day he will be raised. This is before it happened. Jesus knows full well what he's walking into. This is from the Old Testament, Psalm 22. My strength is dried up like baked clay. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You put me into the dust of death. Jesus was on the cross, thirsty. For dogs have surrounded me. Dogs is another word for Gentiles, which is Pilate and the Roman guard. A gang of evildoers have closed in on me. They pierced my hands and my feet. That's Old Testament, y'all. Jesus was in control of every second of this. This was God's plan. God is carrying out the death of a son for you and for me. Jesus wasn't a victim of the culture. He wasn't a victim of the government at that moment. He was in control of all the governments. He was in control of the Jewish Sanhedrin. He used evil for good. God is a great God at recycling. And anything bad that comes at you, he can repurpose for good. Genesis 50:20. What did Joseph tell his brothers? You meant this for evil, but God intended it for good. What is the good? The saving of many lives. The only good person that received bad was Jesus Christ. And he did it willingly, and not only that, he moved the chess pieces so that he would die. He created all of these circumstances for you and for me. But why does he have to die by a cross? Why didn't Jesus just let himself get stoned? And it's because the Old Testament prophecy is that there would not be a broken bone on his body. In fact, we're going to see that in a couple weeks. John specifically mentions not a bone was broken, just like the Old Testament prophecy. But look at Deuteronomy 21. If anyone is found guilty of an offense deserving the death penalty and is executed, and you hang his body on a tree, that's a cross made from wood. You can look it up in the Hebrew. I'm just kidding. Obviously, that's wood. We know that. It's clear as day. You are not to leave his corpse on the tree overnight, but you are to bury him that day. Joseph of Arimathea got his body off the cross and buried him. You must not defile the land the Lord your God has given you. Oh, I'm sorry. For anyone hung on a tree is under God's what? Curse. This is why Jesus became sin. He took God's curse that was let out in the garden from Adam and Eve's sin, and he takes the curse upon himself, hangs on a tree. The fruit came from a tree. Jesus dies on a tree. He takes on the curse, he absorbs the curse, and gives us life. This is what Scripture is trying to tell us. Look at what Paul says in Galatians. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us, because it is written, cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree. Jesus became a curse for you and for me. This is what the simple gospel is, that we can believe in a God that has that kind of love for people who are cursed. What kind of love is that? This means Pilate and the Jews are not in control. People often comment that Jesus seems really cool under pressure. He's not under pressure. He's performing. He's being himself. He's controlling. He's sovereign. Look at verse 33. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you king of the Jews?" So now Pilate's involved. He's already moved back his tea time. Now he's involved. All right, bring him over here. Let me see the guy. So John skipped some parts here, and he's catching us back up with that statement. If you're familiar with this story, you know that John has just transitioned. Luke 23:2 says, "They began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this man misleading our nation, opposing payments of taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is the Messiah, a king.'" Why do they use that? Because they know that Pilate will get involved if we mention taxes and king. That's a death sentence. If you get involved with taxation and you claim to be a king over Caesar, now you're in trouble. So this is where Pilate was like, okay, I have to get involved now. If this goes to my granddaddy, my wife's going to be mad, right? You can see the pressure to perform here and to be excellent. So Pilate hoped to get this problem over to Herod because he ruled over Galilee. Pilate learns that Jesus is from Galilee. Go, "Oh, not my jurisdiction. Go to Herod." Well, Herod doesn't really work out, so he sends him over, and now he's back. Herod sent Jesus back to Pilate, and this is the likely start of the second appearance. So Pilate says to resolve the matter themselves, if they would not bring Pilate an accusation that mattered to him, then they would have to judge him according to their own law and not bother the Romans. That's where Luke 23:2 catches us up to that. Okay, well, he did say something about taxes once, and he says that he might be the king. Now will you kill him? Because if Jesus is claiming to be a king, that's anarchy. And you can hear the doubt or even the sarcasm when Pilate says, "Are you king of the Jews?" If you say yes, it's over. Are you king of the Jews? Now, Jesus is pretty masterful here, but we can also speculate that Pilate has probably seen a fair share of revolutionary attempts to get the Jewish people out of bondage. We can assume that there's been people like Jesus, these political movers, these revolutionaries that have rose to the surface, and they need to be squelched and handled properly. And it might be easy to do it without the fear of death from the Jews. But who would stand up to a Roman official and claim to be king in the light of death? This is where Jesus is. So Pilate is probably not saying this sarcastically, but more like, "Now are you king of the Jews? You're going to say that in my face? With all the power I have and my cool little chest guard here? You're going to say that to a Roman official?" Look at verse 34. "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked. "Or did others talk to you about me?" Jesus is like, here's the question. He rises above the question and serves it right back. So now he's entered into this dialogue with Pilate. And Jesus, I don't think, is trying to be sassy here. It's not really his style. The root of the question will create a different answer. Do you really want to know, or are you asking on behalf of what they are saying about me? If Pilate asked it of himself, the question would have been, "Are you a political king who's conspiring against Caesar?" That's the question that Pilate is asking. If he had asked it on behalf of the Jews, he would have meant, "Are you the messianic king of Israel?" Now, that is the same question, but two totally different responses would come from how you are asking that question. The answer to the first question would be no. The answer to the second question would be yes. So Pilate's response to this question is, "Am I a Jew? I don't care. I don't care what people are saying about you. I have a golf game," right? He's just like wanting to move on. "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied, "I don't get involved with the scuttlebug of Jewish people. I don't really care." And then he says this, "Your own people and chief priests handed you over to me. What is it that you have done?" Look, if you're king of the Jews, your people don't really like you. You may not be voted in next year, all right? What did you do? Why are you in my palace? Why are we having this conversation? What is it that you have done? He's saying, "I just really need to know if I really need to execute you or not." Pilate's almost being patient with Jesus. "I just need to know so that we can move on here." Verse 36, Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest." Thanks, Peter, right? "By the Jewish leaders, but now my kingdom is from another place." Jesus is saying, "I am a king. But not a rival kingdom. My kingdom didn't start here. My kingdom won't end here. My kingdom is otherworldly. Rome doesn't have an issue with my kingdom, not because we're not involved here, but because you have no chance in my kingdom." Jesus did not say that his kingdom was not in the world. He said that it was not of this world. That is, it did not have its source from human origin. Pilate's trying to intimidate with Roman kingdom. Jesus is like, it's apples and oranges here, guys. I'm not really threatened by Rome's power. Rome was the cutting edge of kingdom and dominion. They had to think they had it all figured out. Earthly kingdoms are based upon force and pride and the love of human praise and the desire of dominance and self-interest, and it's all displayed by Pilate and the Roman Empire. But this heavenly kingdom is displayed by Jesus and the cross and is based on love and sacrifice and humility and righteousness. And it's the Jews, a stumbling block, and to the Gentiles, it's foolishness. That's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians. It's all about the power and the pomp and the armies and the navies and the swords and battles and conquering. Rome thought they had power. Jesus says, you don't even know what power is compared to what my kingdom can produce. Here is Jesus looking at this puny palace and this puny kingdom with its puny leaders. I'm not here for your little kingdom. I am the King of Kings. My kingdom will come and it will outlast Rome. So your intimidation tactic, Pilate, not very successful. This is what Pilate says back in 37. You are a king then. You just said it. Gotcha. You said the K word. You're king. Pilate is now investigating. If you are a king, you could be a threat to Rome. I don't really understand what you just said. It's none of this world. But also, the Greek emphasizes the you here. You are a king, then. It emphasizes on the you. You are the king of the Jews. Pilate sees a poor Jewish man in front of him who claims to be a king of the people that want him to die. He's helpless and friendless. It's probably stated with a chuckle due to the audacity of Jesus looking like a king should. His beard's been ripped at this point. He's been slapped at least once. His own people are disowning him and want him dead. And Jesus is saying, my kingdom will outlast all of this. It's this kind of like, Pilate's like, I don't think you really are who you think you are. And Jesus answered, you say that I am a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. So he says, it is true, I am a king. You've said it right. I am a king. I'm here to point people to the reality that is my kingdom, that's made of my truth. Thanks, Crosby. Those who know this truth listen to me. My people listen to me as their king. Jesus said, my sheep listen to my voice. My people listen to their king. My proclamation is my truth. The reason I came here is to point people to the truth. But also notice here, you say that I am a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world, that right there is incarnation and pre-existence from the mouth of Jesus. I was born, I came into this world. I didn't start in this world. I came into this world by birth, incarnation, pre-existence, God in flesh. And the reason that he was born, the reason he came, the reason he dwelt among us is to point and to testify to the truth. And everyone on this side of truth listens to me. And this is where Pilate says a very famous question. What is truth? Now, he doesn't wait for the answer. What is truth? Now, I don't know how he said that. What is truth? Or what is truth? We don't know the emotion behind it, but he walks out. With this, he went out again to the Jews gathered there and said, I find no basis for a charge against him. So he doesn't wait around for the answer. They do have conversations later, but Pilate is saying, truth? How can you be king of truth? Everyone has their own truth. No one can lead with truth. Pilate's like, I'm here for truth. I'm trying to determine the truth. You're saying you're the king who points people to your truth. For Pilate, soldiers and armies were truth. Rome was truth. Caesar was truth. Political power was truth. Psalm 20, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. They collapse and fall, but we rise and stand upright. Pilate's truth is power, prestige, political dominance. And it seems that Jesus doesn't have that kind of power. So don't tell me about truth. You're the one on death row here. Don't tell me truth. Many people ask Pilate's question, but from a different perspective. This is where a lot of people take it and just like harp on the culture bad the rest of the time. Pilate doesn't even understand our culture right now. But what Pilate is experiencing is like a truth crisis. Many things are true only on the basis of personal preference or perspective. They think all truth is personal and individual. We live in a day and age where you live in an echo chamber. You can create it. You listen to what podcast you want to, what book you want to, who you follow on social media, or who you block secretly. We all know you do, right? Like, you will silence anyone that pokes at your truth. This is why truth is such a very valuable topic right now. What is truth? Your truth, that's your truth, don't interfere with my truth. It's all messy because we all don't share the same truth. They think that there is no true truth about God. There is only my truth and your truth, and who's to say one isn't as good as the other? Now, this is very popular, and it will probably be popular for as long as we can imagine, but it denies the one who said, this is why we are sticklers on the truth, because he's the one that said, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. It's not my truth, it's his truth. That's what I'm testifying to. It's not Chase's personal truth and opinion and background and experience. It's his truth. That's his truth. If he's king, he has a right to choose the truth. If you create a universe, you can choose your own truth. Is that fair? Right? We don't need to cower at what truth is. This is not be a jerk with the truth. All right? Because believing truth according to Christ, according to Paul, is not just to believe truth in your head, but to live out the truth. We'll defend truth all day on social media. But when you have to live truth, that's called obedience. What good is it to say, I love my brother and yet not help him? What good is it to say, I love God but not love my brother? I can know truth, experience truth, be really smart, I can quote, I can do, but not live it out. That's called hypocrisy. That's saying, hey, we're trying to kill a guy, but we can't go into your palace. Can you come out on the front step? That's what truth looks like when it's distorted. If you believe the truth, you live it out. That's called obedience. If you believe the truth, you live it out. And maybe this is why so many people are struggling with doubt, because they've grown up in churches that will scream truth from the pulpit, but they don't see it in the hallway and in the community and in the home. We will raise our babies in church, but we will not raise them in Christ. Maybe that's the problem that so many of us struggle. Maybe the next generation walking up and we're scared of them going, I don't know what they're going to do. Maybe if we start taking the Bible serious and actually taking Jesus seriously and actually obeying what he said for us to do, maybe there wouldn't be this room for what is truth. I pray that we know what truth is, and I pray that we live out this truth every day of our life. No matter what it costs, no matter what we have to give up, we give our lives to the King. Why? It's his kingdom. And if you are a follower of Jesus, you've been invited into his kingdom. You live in his order. And here's the best thing. He's a good king. He's not going to stand over you. I can't believe you can't get your life together. He's a good king. How do I know he's a good king? Because he gave up his son to have you in his kingdom. He orchestrated all of this to have you and me. And I don't know about you, but I'm really messed up. I would not have chosen me. I would not have worried about Chase. He's messed up. I was a jerk to my wife last night while writing this. That's the reality. That's reality. Let's just be honest. That's truth. You want truth? That's truth. I'm sorry about that, by the way. Right? We're all messed up, and a king has come into our land, and he's exerting his kingdom outward and says, hey, I want you in my kingdom. I'll die. I'll send my son to die in your place so that I can have you in my kingdom, and then I'm going to use you to expand my kingdom in Norwood, to the nations, and beyond. That's a good king. Let's end here. Verse 39. But this is your custom for me. I'm sorry, I'm back up. He says, what is truth? With that, he went out again to the Jews gathered and said, I find no basis for a charge against him. So Pilate has said, hey, he's not guilty. I don't know what to do with the guy. I'm done. So he finds another way to let Jesus go, and this is what he says. But it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. I looked all over for this. I can't find it. Maybe you can. But according to the history, this was a rumor that this started at some point. That's just a side nerd note, but there you go. So he says, do you want me to release the king of the Jews? They shouted back, no, not him. Give us Barabbas. Now Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. So again, if you're familiar with this text, what is happening here is Pilate said, look, I don't find a fault. He's innocent. He's innocent. But I'll give you Barabbas. He's a messed up thug. He's an insurrectionist. He's a robber. His rap sheet's pretty long. So who do you want? You want Barabbas? Or king of the Jews? This is Pilate's way of like not getting Rome in charge, not killing an innocent man, but like washing his hands of it before he has to literally wash his hands of it and says, they're not going to take a thug. They're going to take king of the Jews who does some cool tricks and heals people and is nice. They're not going to let this Barabbas dude go. But they all shout, no, give us Barabbas. In fact, in Mark 15, it says, in Matthew 27, it says that this was not like a spontaneous response. It wasn't like, no, we definitely want Barabbas. The crowd may have hushed for a second because it's Barabbas. But one deliberately, like the Jewish leaders probably promoted the religious like uprising of the crowd. The chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. So the crowd was kind of like, Barabbas is a bad dude. I don't know about this. And the chief priests and elders know, you definitely want Barabbas. They need to kill that Jesus guy. Oh, okay. All right, give us Barabbas. That was the mindset of the crowd. Barabbas means son of the father. He's considered a terrorist by Rome. He's a freedom fighter, a revolutionary by the Jews, trying to uprise the Jewish name. So maybe he was liked by the crowd. We don't know for sure. But his name means son of the father. Jesus is the son of the father. So who do you want? Some argue that Barabbas' name was actually Jesus. So you either have Jesus here or Jesus here. Which Jesus do you want? But what's really interesting about this is you have a guilty, deserving of death individual on death row, or you have Jesus, and the crowd gets to choose who they kill. And we know from Mark 15 that Jesus was crucified between two criminals. Both were robbers. And I don't know about you, but I just never connected the dots. Jesus not only is chosen over Barabbas, an innocent man, just pronounced innocent, but he also carries the cross of Barabbas to his death. They didn't go and get a cross together real quick, I would assume. So Barabbas' cross is put on Jesus' back, and Jesus dies on Barabbas' cross. Can you see that God is in control of every detail? But here's what I really want you to get into your heart. You're Barabbas. I'm Barabbas. We're guilty. We're the ones that are on death row. We're the ones that should be carrying the cross. We're the ones with the nails that should go into our hands. We're the one that should die by suffocation. We're the ones that should have the wrath of God on our backs, because you and I are messed up, but we have a good king. I will not punish my children. I will punish my son on behalf of those I love. So the cross Jesus hung on upon was probably originally intended for Barabbas, a terrorist and a murderer and a robber set free while Jesus was crucified. And I don't know about Barabbas. I don't know anything from history about him, but that's got to sting a little bit. I mean, that guy's innocent. I'm obviously on death row here, but the people love me. I mean, can you imagine knowing that you're about to die and you see someone stepping and, I'll die in your place. I'll take your cross. I'll take those nails. I'll take that spear. That's the gospel we have. That's the simple gospel that we have. So here's the mystery and the power of the gospel. God treated Jesus like Barabbas so that he could treat us like Jesus. That is what the gospel boils down to into a simple nutshell version. Jesus became Barabbas so that Barabbas could become like Jesus. Barabbas does not deserve to be treated like Christ. He doesn't deserve that. And neither do you, neither do I. Let me end with this. Maybe you've heard this story. It's an old preacher story, but it's pretty good. Some of those are not very good, but this one's actually pretty good. There's a story of a king and someone stealing food from his kingdom. Which, if I'm king, that's a big no-no. That's like number one. Don't steal my food, right? Someone's stealing food from his inventory. So he goes out, sends out a decree. If someone steals food, again, I'm going to whip you 10 times. Next day, food gets stolen. No one gets caught. So the king says, all right, if you get caught, it's 20 now. Next day, food gets stolen. No one gets caught. 30. If I catch you, it's 30. Next day, 40. Next day, 50. Next day, happens again. No one gets caught. King gets sick and tired of it. If I find you, I kill you. The next day, food gets stolen. Somebody gets caught. It's his daughter. Now he has a dilemma, right? If I'm just, if I'm a right king, I have to kill my daughter. I just said I would. She's guilty. She's caught red-handed. She has to die. But he's a good king. So what's he do? He takes off his robe. He lays down his life and sets his daughter free. That's what Jesus is doing here. Not only is he controlling every millisecond of his death, it's prophesied from way, way long time ago, thousands of years, to the detail that no bone would be broken. Why would that be prophesied? So that you could know we have a good king. His name is Jesus. His kingdom did not start here. It will not end here. And he will reign forever, to quote Sandlot. Forever. In 10,000 years, his kingdom will still stand. Stop building your own kingdom. Stop trying to attach yourself to other people's kingdom. Build his kingdom. And what you do here will last forever. We have a good king, church. Let's serve him. You know, let's pray. Father, we thank you for this time that we have. We thank you that you are a good king, that you are in control, that you are sovereign over every detail, every millisecond, that you work in the bad, that you control and use and sovereignly reign even through the hearts of kings. So, Father, I pray now that as we turn our attention to worship again, through song. I pray that we worship you for the king that you are, for the king that you've always been, and for the king that you will always be, that you are a good king, a just king, a righteous king, a holy king. And we have an unfathomable love within this kingdom. So help us, Father. Help us to know truth because Jesus is pointing us the truth. Help us to believe. Help us to know. Help us to trust. I thank you that you are a good king. I praise you for being the king that you are. I don't deserve to unstrap your sandals. I don't deserve to be in your presence. But because Jesus took on the curse, he's taken away my curse, and now I can stand before you in heaven and declare your glory. So help us, Father. Help Village Church to build your kingdom here. In your name I pray. Amen.